Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Peach State Pandemonium. This is Michael Norris, and I am joined by the Georgia gentleman, Gary Oates. Our third wheel is, as he was last week, is somewhere in the Georgia Dome watching the Falcons. I think he may be down on the sidelines helping coach tonight. They ended up losing that game last week.
I know that. Oh, man.
Bobby said they put in the water boy towards or fourth quarter. They have the water boy and the guys with the towels in there.
Evidently.
But hopefully they'll do better tonight since they're on national TV. I can't imagine why. Who are they playing tonight, Jerry? Do you even know?
Cincinnati, the Bengals.
Okay. Well, then we have split loyalties. We have Bobby pulling for one group and Les Thatcher pulling for the Bengals.
I'm sure.
I think Les may be a Washington Redskins fan. I can't remember.
But, I think he did like the Redskins. I think you're right. I think he did.
But I don't know. Since he lives there in Cincinnati, maybe he's will pull for the home team. It's supposed to be on national TV tonight, but I haven't tried to see if they're on.
It's on Fox.
I've been watching Shark Week.
There's some more people that look like seats. You know, I'm going to tell you about those Atlanta fans. They're fair weather fans. You know, they lose two or three, you can sit anywhere.
Well, the Braves people, you know, they were the same way. I love the Braves. In the 80s, because, you know, they had such a bad reputation or a bad record in the early 80s, I could go pay for general admission or bleacher seats and sit behind home plate by the time the game got started good.
34 cents for a ticket, right?
Yeah.
It just about lets you in for free.
You just sit where the camera is. Like we're full. Like McMahon does with his wrestling program. Sit everybody where the camera in front of the camera. Well, it's not on up here, so I don't know. Hey, who knows? I'd be frustrated watching them anyway. I'm kind of anxious to see how the Saints start out this season.
That's going to be very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Because their coach he's suspended for the whole year, right? For the whole season?
Yes. Yes, and cost him about $8 million.
Of course, I'm sure he's not too terribly far away with a walkie-talkie or a cell phone.
I'm sure. I heard he's got a paper out, Slidell, so we can go back.
That reminds me when, just before the Falcons hired Jerry Glanville, I was going somewhere, and was on the interstate, and I pulled off the interstate to the exit. At the bottom of the exit, there was a guy standing there with a sign that said, "We'll coach for food."
I think some of the coaches over the years, that's what they were getting paid.
Actually, I think that was after Glanville. I think that was when, between Glanville and, what was the guy's name, Jim Jones?
Yeah.
Came after that. It was. I know. In fact, I know it was because Jim Jones started when they moved their training facility out to Suwanee, and that's where this guy was. He was standing up the off ramp at the Suwanee exit off of 85.
He might be the general manager now. Who knows?
Could be.
I am not a Falcons fan.
I try to follow them, but I was split for many years between the Falcons and the Saints. But of course, I got away from watching pro football for a while. I didn't even start following the Falcons again until my daughter was a junior cheerleader for them. And so I got.
She was a cheerleader for the Falcons.
Huh?
You said she was a cheerleader for the Falcons.
A junior cheerleader.
Oh, really?
They had junior cheerleaders from ages 6 to 12, I think, 6 to 13, 14, something like that. And, yeah, she did that for 2 years.
Really?
And, yeah, she was 8 or 9, something like that. And but I would volunteer to chaperone to be able to. Otherwise, if your child cheered for them, and you weren't chosen to be a chaperone, you had to pay to get in to see your kids perform. And if your you'd have to buy a ticket. If your kids performed at a pre-show, you had to leave when they left.
Oh, come on, Mike.
Nope.
Well,
that's the reason I always got lucky. I finagled my way into being a chaperone so I could go with them and not cost anything. But what happened, no matter where, you couldn't just drive to the game and drive your child. They had to go as a group. We used to meet at Cumberland Mall at like 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings, and then depending on what time the game was. But they would go either perform at pregame, and I think they performed one time at halftime. But you couldn't stay through the whole game.
That's tacky, isn't it?
You had to leave when they left.
Well, I put in an application to chaperone the big girls, never heard back from them, so I don't know. I think it's when I lost interest in the Falcons.
I think Kathy intercepted that letter.
I think accidentally got to put a stamp on it or something.
But, that was the first year she cheered was the year they went to the Super Bowl. Of course, the junior cheerleaders didn't go to Miami, but and then she cheered the second year.
Well, that's an experience that she always remember.
Yeah, I don't think she cared about it. And she cheered for most of her growing up all the way through junior high. And then she got in band in high school and was with the Flag and Rifle Corps. And she did a little bit of everything, but I think the thing she enjoyed the most was horseback riding, and that was so expensive.
Is she living in Atlanta now?
Yeah, she just moved back. She's living over near Grant Park in an apartment complex, a real nice apartment complex. In fact, she just started her new job this week. I don't know if it's a Montessori school or a private school or something, but it's there in Decatur. And she is a mentor tutor for an autistic child. What
really?
She does is she goes to his classes with him and sits there and keeps him calm and keeps him, just sits with him and makes sure he's paying attention and all that stuff and helps him get through all that. It's a part-time job. She's already got one part-time job, so she's working two part-time jobs. And she interviewed with a couple that were looking for a babysitter 30 hours a week for their autistic child. And
is that what she specializes in, Mike?
Yeah, her she's got a bachelor's degree in special education.
Well, love it, dog.
So, and she interviewed with Emory. Basically, what they wanted at Emory was her to work in a daycare center that they had there, and I bet she wasn't real one way or the other with that. But that's what she wants to do. So the other job she got, she works evenings doing surveys. It's a phone job where you can work from home, and she did that all through. She's been doing that almost a year now. She did that when she was in Milledgeville, and now she's doing it. That's something you can do from anywhere, so she's doing it from there in Atlanta, but she's still looking for another full-time job as well on top of it. tutoring thing. So.
Well, I'm sure she'll land something if she can deal with that.
Yeah, she keeps plugging away at it, she will. So the main thing I told her just to not get, you know, settle down into the two jobs that you've got, because it is a lot. I mean, work even at the part-time job, that's still, she works from basically 10 o'clock in the morning till sometimes 10 o'clock at night. And so the main thing I told her was just not get bogged down in that, and to you know, keep looking and give up the survey thing once she finds a full-time job. But anyway, I know nobody called in or was listening. Wanted to hear about me bragging
on
my
daughter. Well, if they called in, they're going to listen to it for a while.
Well, let's. I'm gonna take a quick break, real quick, and then we get back. We'll get our special guests Tom Burke and Ross Hart on the line with us, and we'll take it from there. So I'm gonna take a quick break to pay the bills. We'll be right back.
That you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24 Saturday night. Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24 Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkle or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? That happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling, and you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there. I know you carry Terry and Peterman's card in your wallet just in case.
I got Jody's card right. I got him on speed dial.
In case you get bit by that coyote coming.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'm going to do this in two parts. I'm going to call up Tom first, and then we'll call and get Ross on. I'm going to try to call, to have two different guests call, so hopefully this will work. If not, we'll back up and punt.
That's what the Falcons just did.
today.
Yes, hello.
Hey, Thomas, Michael Norris, and Jerry Oates. How you doing?
Hey, Mike, how are you?
All right. And just to anybody that's listening in, we are joined by historian extraordinaire, Mr. Tom Burke.
Okay. Hold on for 1 minute.
England. All right.
Yeah, okay. Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you for the introduction. We had a wonderful time when you were visited north of the Mason-Dixon line up here and visited with me for a day. It was a real treat.
That was extraordinary. I don't know if I'm south of the Mason-Dixon line. Where is Baltimore? Is Baltimore south of the Mason-Dixon?
Yeah. Mason-Dixon line is anything under below Maryland, I believe.
Well, I'm in Maryland.
You're in Maryland right now. Oh.
Yeah, I'm 15 miles southwest of Baltimore. Maryland. My show is going to be in Laurel, Maryland, which the only thing I'd ever heard from Laurel or about Laurel, Maryland, and that's where George Wallace was shot.
That's interesting.
But anyway, through the good graces of Mr. Burke, our second guest is Tom has hooked us up with, and I'm going to try and get him on the line too, Ross Hart. So bear with me just a second, and I'll dial the other number, and we'll get Ross on with us, and we'll get rolling on. What I want to talk about, we get him on, Tom. I know you were close to or knew Red Bass Steen, so.
Yep, just one second there, and let me hook up here. Yes, hello?
That's me calling.
Yeah, New York, is that you?
I should say Los Angeles.
Yes, hello?
Mike.
Yes.
Okay, let me turn the volume up on this. Okay, I think we are.
Okay, there we are.
Hello, this is Ross.
Hey, Ross, this is Michael Norris and Jerry Oates, welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. How are you doing this evening?
Just fine, Michael.
I was just telling Tom, it held off till I got you guys on with us. I wanted to talk a little bit about Red Bass Steen because Jerry worked with him a little bit. I knew Tom was close to him, and he was, I guess you were, fairly young when he passed through Calgary working for your dad. Did you ever connect with him or do anything with Red later on?
I did at the Cauliflower Alley Club and also when he was an agent for the WWF in 1984. He had come to scout some of our talent and at the time helped facilitate the sale of the Stampede Wrestling promotion to the WWF when Vince McMahon expanded his empire to Canada and the States, and Red was acting on his behalf. And at that time, he was sort of out of wrestling, but I was just so impressed with his professionalism and how well spoken he was of all our talent. And later, he had sent a number of really good prospects to Stampede Wrestling when my dad restarted the promotion in 1986. He had sent Steve DeSalvo and the Angel of Death, Steve DeSalvo and Dave Sheldon, two of his better prospects to Stampede Wrestling, and Red really taught them well. And so, you know, I knew him as a great technician in the ring, a great agent, a great booker, and you know, a really excellent spokesperson for wrestling, and a true gentleman, a first class act.
That's what I wrote. I never had the pleasure of meeting him because he came to the Mobile reunion a couple of times prior to me starting to go there, so I never got the opportunity to meet him. But everybody that I know has ever crossed paths with him talked about what a wonderful person he was.
Yeah, just a wonderful fellow, and what an accomplished wrestler. You know, he had gone to so many different promotions, the AWA, Texas, Florida, California, Japan, and Australia, and such a smooth wrestler. You know, he was a great high flyer, an excellent single star and a really good tag team technician, and that's what made him a great spokesperson and a teacher later.
He actually started training people early, and I didn't realize this till Bill Bowman told me. He actually helped train Billy Wicks and got Billy Wicks started in the business.
Yes, he did, and you know, a number of other wrestlers he started out were Sting and Bryan Adams, you know, who went on to be very successful in WCW and WWF. But you know, he had a lasting impact and positive impression on so many younger wrestlers that some fans and wrestlers today don't even know of. And you know, and that's just how modest Red was. You know, he never asked for that recognition or attention, but you know, he had such a positive impact on guys he wrestled and later guys that he taught and instructed on the ins and outs of the business and breaking them in.
Tom, what were your dealings with him? I know you were close to him at one point.
Well,
was it just $20
well,
dollars by
wrestling? Yeah, I met Red years earlier, before I even was in the CAC and before he would join CAC. But when Lou Fez retired as president, Red was voted in, and Red had a progressive mind for the CAC. Not that Lou did a great job as well, but Red, one of the first things he did, he started to utilize the theme for each CAC. Event. And the one which he had, the first one under his presidency, was the Art of Wrestling. And what he did was he invited professional wrestlers who were also artists to display their work at the annual reunion. And we had Steve Strong, George Gordienko sent down some work. And some of the other wrestlers, Ted Lewin was another one, and everything. So it was a very interesting. And then you know, it gave a different theme. It broadened the interest of fellow mat men and women as artists, other than being artists within the ring, but also outside the ring. So I really enjoyed that.
Then
he had another theme.
Say
again, please.
Don Fargo, did he ever have anything? I don't
recall if Don's work was displayed or not. But Don had appeared at CAC over the years.
Yeah, I know he's gone out there. He usually has more fun on the plane ride out there than he does while he's actually out there.
Right. Yeah.
Hopefully they keep his clothes on him while he's out there.
Yeah, that's the truth, yeah.
Well, Jerry, I know you mentioned before we went on the air that you had been around Red a little bit. Did you wrestle him or team with him? Or
yeah, I teamed with him out in Kansas City. He was he came out there quite a bit because he'd be in St. Louis, and they'd bring him in there. I hooked up with him there a few times, and what a great guy. Like Ross said, he was just a super guy, and you know, he's a great piece of talent, and it was a pleasure being around Red. Just like you, first time I met him, it's like I'd known him forever.
I agree with you, Jerry. Red was very, very open to everyone. Not
yes,
only
he was.
Within the framework of the business, but people outside the business as well. He was from that era where he was a gentleman, and he didn't have to utilize his swear words or anything of that nature to get himself over. It was his talent within the ring, you know, whether it were babyface or heel, you know. He was very good.
He just had that personality in and out of the ring.
Absolutely.
He really did. Was Red living in Dallas?
He lived in Dallas for quite a few years. Then he moved when he took ill, they sent him back to his home state in Minnesota. And he stayed there in a... nursing home was specialized in Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was his request that he return there.
That was his
Minneapolis.
What was that, Mike? I didn't hear you.
No, that was, this was Jerry.
Was his home in Minneapolis. Yeah, I think he was from St. Paul originally, I think, Jerry.
Oh, okay.
I think that's how he was a carnival shooter before he became a professional, and I think that may be how he and Wicks knew each other. I'm sure if he and Wicks were running together, then Greg Peterson was in that mix somewhere, because Greg was also from St. Paul, and he and Wicks were friends from, well, not quite childhood, but, you know, their teenage years on. And so I'm sure Greg Peterson was in that mix as well. And he probably had a hand in helping Greg get the business.
And then, you know, he had his big push. His first big push was when he came with Lou Pine as the Bastien brothers, Red and Lou Bastien. And Lou was, you know, Lou Pine was an old hand, but it was interesting that they, instead of being the Pine brothers, they became the Bastien brothers. Both of them had red hair, and they had a gimmick when they would come to the ring. This now where I'm talking the late 50s, early 60s. They come in the ring with a chest, open this chest, and throw out silver dollars. You know, so that was a unique thing. And I asked Red how much did we think he threw out. He figured they got too expensive when they got to the $300 mark, and they stopped it.
Oh man, they should have come to take a swing through New Orleans and picked up some Mardi Gras coins or something.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Or those necklaces that they wear. You know, but it got over.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Everybody was fighting for ringside seats, thinking they're going to get some money thrown at them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they throw out a couple, you know, if a person caught two silver dollars there, that was probably half the price of a ringside seat back then.
Exactly. They did that gimmick a couple of times in Mobile. Bob Kelly, talking about Don Fargo, he had a thing going with Fargo, and Fargo was working under a mask as Mr. D. And Fargo put up $100 or something that nobody could unmask him or whatever the deal was. But Kelly said if he would unmask him, if he got that $100, he was going to throw it ringside.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much he actually threw, but they did that. And then the next week, he worked against a guy that was working as the Black Parent, who was Fargo's partner.
Oh.
He unmasked him and threw the money out of the audience. When they unmasked him, they identified him as Johnny Valentine, but it was actually Greg, and he was working as Johnny Fargo at the time.
Oh, okay.
So that was November or so of 1971, but I don't know how much money. I never had thought to ask Kelly how much money he actually threw, but I'm sure it wasn't really $100.
Did you have anything like that up in your territory?
One time after a ladder match, there was like $1,000 supposedly that was hung up from the lights, and Dan Crawford had actually won the ladder match, and just as he had climbed up and gotten the money, he was jumped by Kendo Nagasaki and his manager George Gillette, who wrestled as Lord Sloan, and Dan was apparently going to give it to charity, but then Lord Sloan took several dollar bills and just threw them to the crowd. But it was really just to show his disdain for the peasant fans. So it was a great angle, and it got over really well. But I don't think there was $1,000 that was thrown, not that much really, but probably about $100, and that seemed like a lot to the fans back in 1972.
I can imagine a promoter seeing that being thrown. You see how George Gulis would, or Nick Gulis would react to that? Somebody
would be in the audience trying to get the money back.
no, definitely not. He couldn't fire him because he would have to take it off their wages for the next few months, though. So he'd have to hang on to them as wrestlers still. But anyway.
I think you guys, the Stampede, did a lot of talent trades with England, but I didn't realize that Nagasaki worked in North America.
Yeah, I think this was the only promotion he wrestled in. It was Stampede Wrestling in 1972. We had brought a number of wrestlers over prior to that, including Billy Robinson, Les Thornton, Black Angus, Danny Lynch, Hans Striger, you know, all came from the UK. And he came over in the fall, actually the summer of 1972, and he got over great. He had that samurai sword, and he would lunge from one corner to the opposite corner where his opponent was, and he would thrust that sword, and it would come just, it would just touch the tip of the wrestler's chest, you know, just it would just grace the wrestler's chest, and scared the hell out of a few wrestlers. And they were just told, don't move, because if you move, it might hit you or it might nick you, you know. So the wrestlers were just told to stand absolutely still and appear shrieked and shocked, just as the fans were and the wrestlers were. And it was amazing that he could come that close, you know, without actually cutting their chest with this sword. And it was a real sword, too. But he had a good run, and he stayed for about 6 months. And Lord Sloan, or George Gillette, his manager, was one of the best mouthpieces I'd ever seen. You know, just a great orator, and he got over great. Mind you, he had gotten over very well in England on television, and was one of the best mouthpieces I'd seen for a manager. But this was unfortunately the only place where he wrestled. I don't think he had that much desire to travel, and other than a few trips to Japan, maybe a couple to the Middle East, I think. Peter Thornley, Nagasaki, only wrestled in the UK, but he was a legend there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was still, he retired for several years and then came back. I don't know if he's actually still working now. I don't know what the situation is in England as far as whether or not they still have the stuff. But I have touted on here several times, and I discovered World of Sport probably, I don't know, 8-9 years ago. And I have finally gotten my hands on some DVDs of it. And just the style of wrestling that they had over there, it was so, it's just so different. It was treated so much more legitimately over there, the way the play-by-play was called, to the way they actually had public warnings. They did an around system. It's just a unique thing. And a lot more mat wrestling and stuff like that than was so predominant in the States.
Yeah, and it seemed easier to get heat with the fans. You didn't have to work as hard. You didn't have to brawl outside the ring or use gimmicks or see blood. Wrestlers could do very little and get a great reaction. The heels could get over very subtly, just using a closed fist or not breaking on the ropes, or falling on somebody after they had slammed him, because if a guy fell to the mat, you were supposed to stand back and let him get back on his feet, just like in boxing. And if you committed little infractions like that as a heel, it got great reaction from the fans, and baby faces could sell and really get sympathy. And it seemed much simpler, but a lot easier to get over with fans there than in North America or Japan, where audiences were very quiet, although they certainly appreciated technical wrestling in Japan.
And they also had a lot more weight classes. I mean, they had a lot of smaller guys. I think Tony Charles, before he came to the States, he was considered what they call a welterweight. I don't know what the weight classes were as far as actual weights, but I think he was a welterweight. One of the discs I have had Dave Finley early in his career. He was a heavy welterweight, whatever that was. He was their champion in that weight class at that time, and he got heat just by the girl that was at ringside with him, and she really didn't do anything. She would make a move towards the ring, and it would draw the fans up on their feet, and it's what Jerry and I and Bobby, when he's with us, we talk about it all the time, how simple, you know, it could be, or it was back in those days. It wasn't easy, but it was simple. You could do simple things that would draw heat.
Ross and I were talking. Excuse me, Michael. Ross and I were just talking about that the other day in regards to Goldie Rogers, who would take like forever to take off his jacket. You know, that would explode the fans into momentous heat.
Yeah, you take 10 minutes to first take his sunglasses off, and as soon as the fans started to boo or the babyface motioned to the referee to get the match started, and Goldie Rogers then would have to start the whole procedure over. It couldn't be interrupted, and finally, after 4 or 5 minutes of taunting and motioning to take his glasses off and refusing because the crowd wasn't cooperating or they were interrupting him, then he would take another 5 or 6 minutes to take his jacket off, and it was a great heat getter, and it just set the pace for the rest of the show. You know, once Goldie Rogers, you know, who was ideal just as a preliminary star when it would get the opening matches over, once he got his heat with the fans, the rest of the show was really easy. You know, the guys never had any problems getting any heat with the fans. Goldie would get them off to a great start. So there are a lot of great character wrestlers like Goldie Rogers, even though they never really were vaulted much into the main events, but they were great preliminary stars and helped get cards over.
Well, that was what the purpose of, you know, the opening matches were. They were the purpose of those were to set the pace for the rest of the evening. And, having grown up in the Mobile territory and a little bit in Georgia, we had guys that got as much heat in the opening matches as they did in the main events. Of course, Mobile was a small territory. They carried a small crew. So they could have a guy, he'd be opening match for 3 or 4 weeks, and then slowly they'd move him up the card. He'd main event for a month or so and then move him back down the card, and that way it kept it fresh. And, we had a few guys that were pretty much strictly prelim guys, but most of those were, and they were great wrestlers. They were journeymen. They worked everywhere. Guys like Tony Russo and Gypsy Joe Rosario and people like that. You know, that was their role was to work the first opening or second match. You know, then they'd go off to another territory and they'd come back. But we never had squashes, even on TV. I never saw a squash until I started watching Georgia Championship Wrestling. Matches were always competitive, and even though you say you had somebody like the late Al Goodwin who worked as Black Bart, he may be working with Ken Lucas on TV. Ken Lucas was a longtime favorite there. You pretty much knew Ken Lucas was going to go over, but you never said for sure. You could never tell for sure because it was such a competitive match. And you know, I guess I was lucky being able to grow up seeing stuff like that, because it made a whole lot of difference when I was. A late, you know, teenager or my early 20s, but the first time I saw Georgia Championship Wrestling, every match was a squash. I'm like, wow, you know, it was unbelievable. Of course, when I got in the business, that was my role. I was a job guy that did TV jobs. But it was not what I was used to seeing growing up. And I lose the job.
Ross, no, Ross, is anybody running up your way now? Are you guys doing anything?
I'm not too involved with wrestling now. There are a couple of promotions, PWA out of Edmonton, and I believe there's RWF. They're both out of Edmonton, and they're running local shows in Calgary and Edmonton, Red Deer, a few other areas, and Bob Leonard ran a successful promotion in Regina about 3 weeks ago with the Agricultural Exhibition Society. But I have a nephew who just started wrestling, Matthew Hardy. He's the son of my oldest brother, Smith, and he's just getting his feet wet with wrestling, but I think he's got some potential. And, you know, my niece Natalia is doing very well in WWE, and she achieved her dream of winning the women's title. And my other nephew Tyson Kidd is doing quite well there. He's had a surge recently in the WWE, and
My nephew Harry Smith, he was formerly D.H. Smith, is going back to New Japan. He's going to be wrestling there in the fall. So I'm very happy with the younger generation of the Hart family and how well represented our family has been by these young stars. I think they've all got great futures.
That's wonderful.
I was just telling Jay before we were on the air, I didn't realize, I knew that you came from a large family, but I didn't realize there were 12 of them.
Yeah, 12. 8 boys, 4 girls. And the girls could hold their own against the boys, too, so.
I told him you guys alone are going to be able to surpass the Welch family before too much longer in office.
We're working our way up there for sure.
Now, were you ever in the ring? I know you did a lot of promoting and stuff and helping with Stampede. Did you ever compete in the ring at all?
I did, not on the level that, Brett and Owen did. I did more promoting and behind-the-scenes work, but I did wrestle in Europe, actually, in 1983. I actually had my first matches over in Austria and Hungary, of all places, working for a fellow named Arpad Weber, who Tom was familiar with, and then I went to wrestle in England for Max Crabtree at Joint Promotions, and that was a great experience. I got the chance to work with some real veterans, great stars at that time, like Fit Finley and Skull Murphy, Marty Jones, and that was where my brother Owen debuted as well. And Owen definitely had the talent. We knew he had the potential at that time. I finished my university and went on to work more for the promotion of Stampede Wrestling behind the scenes, and there was more of a need for that for me. But I always enjoyed wrestling when I did. I knew I wasn't going to be a star on the level of Brett or Owen, but it was a great opportunity to perform and see what got over with the fans. I felt just by wrestling I had a greater appreciation of timing and psychology, and that way I could project those directions and expectations to guys as a booker myself. I felt that I was involved in every aspect of the industry, TV, color commentating, editing the television show, booking, promoting, being a talent scout. So, I'm blessed that I had an opportunity to fulfill all those roles in the wrestling industry.
When did your dad start that territory?
My dad started in 1948 and he retired in 1990, so very, very close to 50 years promoting. I think there was only about a year and a half gap when he was bought out by the WWF in 1984, and they had first run their live cards there, and they weren't very well received. They were using the squash job matches from Maple Leaf Wrestling in Ontario, and that didn't get over very well with our TV audiences in Western Canada. They had always been accustomed to seeing hard-fought competitive matches, and all of a sudden they were reverted more to the TV studio type matches, which were over 1 or 2 minutes, and it didn't get over that well, and their crowds weren't very big. And mind you, it was before Hulkamania was really launched, and later he debuted the British Bulldogs as a tag team and the Hart Foundation. I think that helped the WWF get established in Western Canada. But my dad, anyway, ended up restarting the promotion in 1985 and then, continued promoting right till 1990. He had a great career, so very, very close to 50 years of promoting and all over Western Canada and breaking in some of the best names in the business or launching a lot of their careers if you didn't break them in.
Right.
That's true. Did you ever get the opportunity to go to Calgary?
No, I never did, no.
We weren't lucky enough to have you. I wish we had.
I would have loved to have gone. I really would have. A lot of territories I didn't go to that I wish I had made it.
Did you make it into Canada at all? Did you work anywhere like in the Maritimes or
No,
maybe in Ontario?
I wanted to go up there for them, and I never did. I only worked in London, Ontario, a few times for the Bear Man.
Yes, yes.
I went up there for him when I was in Detroit. I'd go on, you know, go into Detroit on Saturdays, and then Sundays I would go there for him. But that's the only time.
Yeah, the Bearman had a promotion.
I always wanted to go in there for the Rougeos, but I never did. I mean the Cormiers.
Yeah, the Cormiers had an excellent circuit. They ran all over Atlantic Canada, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, PEI, and it was one of the best promotions in Canada, although they only ran the summer and fall principally, but it drew very well. You know, they had some terrific shows in Halifax, Charlottetown, Moncton, the Burks, or the Cormiers in New Brunswick, sort of like what the Hearts were in Calgary. You know, they had a tremendous following, and all of them had their own styles. There was the Beast, who was more of a brawler, Leo, who was an excellent technician in the ring. Rudy and Bobby, you know, so they certainly made their mark on Atlantic Wrestling, like the Von Erichs in World Class or the Hearts in Stampede Wrestling in Western Canada. So it was a good circuit.
It really was. I heard nothing but great things. But you guys ran year-round, right?
Yes, we did. I think only one or two seasons my dad didn't run in the summer, and he found that it was really hard to start up in September if he was closed in July or August. You know, he would have lost his continuity, and it was hard to hold on to wrestlers because they would have to get work elsewhere for 2 months, and then a lot of them didn't want to, you know, come back because they had already gotten established in other promotions. So my dad started running year-round. You know, he experimented to see how it would go, and he did very well with it. You know, we found we were able to draw quite well in July and August, and you know, just keep our continuity going.
Was your business better in the summer or winter?
Definitely in the winter. You know, in the winter, if it was cold out, people like to be in the hot, smoky pavilion, and you know, we always drew better in the winter. We had less outdoor events to, you know, or the vacations to compete against. But
right.
If we had hot programs, you know, we could draw all year round. But traditionally, our best months to draw usually were January to March, and then things would really pick up for our Stampede when we'd bring in the world champion for our big shows during our rodeo in July. And then things would drop off a little bit for the rest of July, and then pick up very well in the fall again.
How many towns a night did y'all run?
We usually ran six nights a week, sometimes seven. And when we had a lot of wrestlers, sometimes we'd run a double circuit, and we'd have two shows running a night from Monday to Thursday, and then we'd just run Calgary on Fridays and Edmonton on Saturdays. But generally, six out of seven nights a week, the boys are always working.
Right.
You dropped down some into the States, too. Didn't you guys go into, like, Montana?
Yeah, we sure did. We ran Montana. We ran Billings, Great Falls, some of those places. My dad initially, even when he started running in the early 50s, he was running as far as Seattle and all along the West Coast, but that was a bit too far, especially by automobile. You know, there wasn't a lot of air travel at that time, so principally we just ran Alberta, Saskatchewan, a few parts of Manitoba. We didn't want to cause any rifts with the AWA at that time, but we did run quite a few shows in Montana, you know, very close to the Alberta-Saskatchewan borders.
How did they do?
Not bad. You know, a big problem for us was getting a lot of our non-American wrestlers across the border. There are a lot of stories there where wrestlers were using different IDs and...
No, come on.
Different names just to get across the border and having to cover up their accents. Even some of our Atlantic wrestlers or those with Eastern accents or some from the UK had to forge an accent. Sandy Scott, who is one wrestler and a referee, he was a real Scotsman, and he changed his name to Elton Stanton. I think he was using Tom Stanton's driver's license to get across the border, and usually these border guards never looked very closely at the license to see there wasn't a lot of resemblance there, and Sandy would always forge a southern accent to sound like Tom Stanton, who wasn't even southerner. He was, I think, from Pennsylvania, but he got across and was never ever questioned. You know, it was quite comical, but for the most part, we couldn't get a lot of our non-American wrestlers across the border until the late 80s, and, you know, that was with a lot of arm twisting by my dad and having to deal with everyone from immigration to the governor in Montana, you know, to petition non-American wrestlers to work there. So that was always a difficulty because then, you know, our non-Americans couldn't get across the border, and Stu still had to kind of pay them anyway because it wasn't their fault that they couldn't compete in the U.S. But we had some really successful shows there in the mid-80s. There was the type of area you had to run often, and you had to try and build up some local stars, you know, to keep a local flavor with the fans there.
No.
Did you run that year around?
Sure did. Yeah, we used to, it would actually go in there live in most places on Saturdays. They would pick up a feed right from Calgary, and they would see it live on Saturday afternoons, which was great. You know, so that, you know, that made our show very current there.
How many guys did y'all carry normally?
I'm sorry?
How many guys did y'all carry?
Oh, geez. At times my dad had 20, 25 wrestlers, some who would work part-time, just work locally, and there were always guys kind of just breaking into the business, and some of them wouldn't work full-time, but they were just chomping at the bit waiting, you know, to get their opportunity. But a lot of times we had too many wrestlers. My dad sometimes didn't have the heart to let wrestlers go or give them their notice. So at times we always had a few too many. So then we would run a double circuit, and that wasn't a bad idea. But it, you know, it meant extra rings and extra transportation, and sometimes it was wasn't worth the aggravation with all the travel involved. And if you had vehicles that weren't reliable, you know, it sometimes was precarious. But it gave a lot of the boys an opportunity to work, and so, you know, quite often our crew would have anywhere from 16 to 20 wrestlers on a show.
Were your towns far apart?
Yeah, we geographically would try to run shows, you know, a reasonable distance from each other, but, you know, we ran, you know, probably on a 2,500-mile basis every week. You know, we would run shows in Saskatchewan and northern Alberta, sometimes on the Indian reserves, and in northern BC and places like Montana. So there was a lot of travel for wrestlers, you know, from Monday to Thursday. You know, they're traveling often 200-300 miles a show. So weekends were a little lighter, but they only usually had Sundays to relax and get ready for the next 4 days on the road. So, but, you know, we had a pretty good territory. We had shows all over the interior and Okanagan region of BC, pretty much all over Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Montana. But, you know, we always had to expand our circuit to further away, you know, to towns further away, because otherwise you'd overexpose yourself if you ran too often in some of the same spot shows. So, you know, we were always looking for new towns, and sometimes you had to expand your borders and run very far away shots.
Right.
just to, you know, expand your promotion and not burn yourselves out in the same towns with the same audiences too often.
Was Calgary your biggest town?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, definitely. And that's where we did our TV tapings every Friday. But Edmonton was very comparable to Calgary. We'd run it on Saturdays, and we would draw very similar to Calgary. You know, if business was good, we'd usually get 2,000 fans every Friday night, and then Saturday night in Edmonton. And, you know, our best towns after that were places like Regina, Saskatoon, Vancouver. You know, we eventually ran there in the 80s, and we had some very good business there.
Your TV, did you do a studio taping or?
No, we usually we taped live at the matches Friday night. So we usually just showed the highlights of matches. We'd usually pick up a match in progress, so because we would shoot five or six matches on a one-hour show, and then that was interspersed with interviews and promos for angles and upcoming spot shows, you know, where our TV show is going to. We would usually pick up a match in progress and show the last 7 or 8 minutes, so a little different than the studio format of most other TV promotions at that time. And, you know, it seemed to work well in the 60s and 70s, but, you know, when the newer format was introduced with the WWF, I think fans wanted to see more of a complete match, you know, from start to finish. So we certainly had to kind of adopt that format, you know, and that, you know, was a bit of an adjustment for our fans, but it made sense. Sometimes you have to go with the, you know, you have to go with the trend at that time, especially with you know, the bigger TV shows with the high tech productions, and, you know, certainly couldn't doubt you know, WWF's production value on their shows. So, but traditionally that was our format, and it worked for a number of years.
Did you have to bicycle your tape around, or it was seen all over?
We had to bicycle our tapes around. You know, it was seen live on Saturdays, you know, by most cities, say, within a 90, 100-mile basis or distance from Calgary. But then we would have to send the tapes to the other places. We would be seen in Edmonton the following weekend, and then 2 weeks later in Saskatchewan, in those markets. So, you know, so we always had to shoot a lot of live angles in those shows and try and keep them current with the TV show. So, you know, a lot of that was estimating and planning, and if guys got hurt or injured, you know, or suddenly new guys came in, you know, sometimes that threw your TV a little bit out of whack. But yeah, we certainly had to stagnate our TV because it wasn't live in all our audiences.
Yeah, and people don't realize when, you know, like a tape could be, you know, like 2 weeks, you know, after you've done, you got to keep up with all that, where it is and who was on it. And
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, trying to keep the continuity of the live shows, you know, in sync with the
flow
TV
of what's
and
going. Yeah,
it's not easy, you know, but for the most part, if you could count on your wrestlers, if nobody walked out on you, or if nobody got injured, you know, or missed a match, you know, it could work. But, you know, it certainly provided some improvisation and advanced planning.
Now, did Canada have anything similar to what the States had with TBS, a Superstate or something like that, that went coast to coast? Or did you guys get TBS in Canada at all?
We didn't until probably the early 80s. You know, so our TV show was pretty much just local. You know, our TV stations weren't picked up by national networks, you know, probably until the mid to late 80s. You know, although our wrestling show was seen in the 70s, we were sending our tapes to Toronto, and they were seen there. So Frank Tunney was bringing in some of our wrestlers to work on his shows there just because our show had been very well received, and they brought in a number of our guys to work on his shows there, including Mark Lewin and King Curtis and John Quinn and some of them. But you know, I think that was for about a 5-year period, and then when TSN became the national sports network like ESPN here, our show went all across Canada at that time. So, you know, from about 1984, 1985 on, you know, we were seen all over Canada, which was great exposure.
When TBS actually hit up there, did it have any effect on what you were doing, or people wanted to see some of the guys that was on TBS?
We never saw any of the TBS stars, I don't think, until the Nitro Awards, maybe. I think WWF was the first American, you know, syndicated show to be on our airwaves here. You know, I don't think we got anything from AWA or WCW or anything like that. So it was pretty much WWF, and then nothing until the Raw Nitro Wars, you know, in the 90s, years later. So the only exposure there was, you know, through the magazines and some of the newsletters, you know, that right. mentioned Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat and some of those stars. So our fans are certainly familiar with him, but there wasn't any TV exposure to them.
How did the world champions roll for you guys?
Very well. You know, it was always the climax of our shows. Each year during our stampede, we'd bring in the world champion to face our top star. He was billed as North American champion, and they were great matches. But, you know, it was characteristic of the guys who were champions at that time, Dorian, Terry Funk, Gene Kaniski, Harley Race, Jack Briscoe. You know, they were all outstanding workers, and they had some excellent matches against some of our stars. But Nick Bockwinkel, we actually brought him in as the AWA champion as well. And, you know, he was a tremendous worker. And the good thing about all those champions, they never dropped a title, but they always made your stars look like they could have just about won the title. You know, they were that close to winning the title. It always gave our fans hope that they might see a title change. Some were classic one-hour draw matches or very competitive, hard-fought struggles. And our guys always looked like they were that close to being world champions. So that was certainly a testament to the champions who came in at that time. And, you know, I credit some of those world champions who were working probably, you know, over 40 weeks of the year and working four or five nights a week. And night after night, they were just having outstanding matches. You know, they worked very hard to get your local champions over. And not every territory, I guess, had a high caliber of stars, but they certainly made them look, you know, like they were high caliber. So, you know, my hat's off to all those champions, you know, who represented the NWA and, I guess, the AWA very well. And even the WWF, Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino and some of his defenses outside of the Northeast, you know, always looked very good and did a tremendous job of putting over the guys they wrestled.
Did
the world
Bruno
champion
work Stampede once?
I'm sorry?
Did Bruno work a Stampede show?
Bruno did. He came in, I think 1964. He came in, yeah, you know, it was just maybe a year after he had won the title from Buddy Rogers, and they were trying to get him exposure across Canada, you know, as a defending champion. So he came in and he wrestled Waldo Von Erich during our Stampede and did tremendously well. We had a pretty large Italian population, and you know, at that time we didn't have TV to really promote Bruno, but the magazines had publicized him so much. You know, he was getting so much coverage in the magazines, and he drew very well for us. But that was the only time we ever had a WWF title defense.
Yeah. Who did he work against? Do you remember?
He worked against Waldo Von Erich.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, he'd wrestled Waldo, I think, in Toronto and in the WWF already, so it was a natural rivalry there. And aside from that, we always had the NWA champions right up till the mid-80s when we switched our affiliation and brought Nick Bockwinkel as the AWA champion in.
How often would you bring the NWA world champion? More than once a year? Or
usually twice a year. We would always bring them in for the Stampede, and if we were lucky, we could get them for one more booking midway through the year, like maybe January or February. But we usually always had a reservation. You know, we had reserved bookings for the NWA champions in July for about 10 days. And, you know, they would do a full circuit usually for 9 days. And my dad kept them pretty busy. They never got too many days off. I think they'd get a Sunday off, but they were working every other day in Calgary, Edmonton, and Saskatchewan. Mind you, we tried to accommodate the champions and fly them to as many of those shows as we could. But Stu had them very busy, you know, appearing at Stampede functions and with the rodeo and the Hayes breakfast and in the Stampede parade, which was seen all over television audiences in Canada. But it was great PR, and I think the champions all had a lot of fun, but they were kept very busy during those 9 days they came up to work for us.
how much. See, Jerry, you would fit right in. If you'd have gone there straight from Oklahoma, those trips in Calgary would seem like a piece of cake.
Good, like being off. Oh, man.
Well, you guys went up into Alaska periodically, too, didn't you?
We did. I think the last time we ran there might have been, about 1972, but they didn't have paved roads, and driving was a nightmare up there. You know, it was about a 15-hour drive. So we didn't run we couldn't make too many trips up there. It was just too time-consuming. We always had to get back to run our shows in Calgary. If we could have gotten a deal with one of the smaller airlines and flown our wrestlers up there, that would have been great, but we were limited to car travel, and it just made it almost impossible, you know, unless we had a split crew, and that's what we did a few times. We would send one crew to work up there for 4 or 5 days, but it was pretty barren, pretty isolated back then, not a lot of services, you know, there wasn't much nightlife for the wrestlers, but, you know, we always drew well there because there wasn't much other entertainment going on.
I don't know if you know or not, but Jerry's former brother-in-law, Dick Steinborn, also worked with you guys up there for a while.
Yeah, Dick, he wrestled, I think, I believe late 50s or early 60s, and my dad knew his father, Milo, very well, but Dick also came back. He was actually a booker for us in 1979 and wrestled as Mr. Wrestling, and then he came in a year later and dropped the World Junior Heavyweight title to my brother Bruce in a classic stampede match, but he was a very smooth worker, Dick, and he had great psychology in the ring. I enjoyed watching him wrestle a lot.
I'm surprised he didn't try to run you to take over the business.
not quite, but
he was on with us quite a bit last year, and we made him our unofficial booker and producer.
Wow.
if you've been around Dick, you know his personality, and you know why we did that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, he loved the business, and he was a great psychologist, and, you know, one of his great strengths was utilizing any wrestlers and finding some talent or strength that they had and bringing it out in them, you know, even if they were green or they were you know, they were incapable in some ways or had some flaws. Dick would always highlight whatever strength or passion they had and bring that out of them. So, you know, I always respected him for that. He seemed to have that ability to bring out the best in wrestlers.
How long would you keep top guys, you know, that were drawing for you?
Some had pretty good runs here. You know, usually about 9 to 10 months. You know, if they were working on top, other than some of our local wrestlers who stayed with us all the time, and then they would try to get booked out to Japan or maybe Germany or even Puerto Rico just to give their faces a rest a little bit. But for those imports that came into our territory, if they had a 8 or 9 month run, that was great, and then they would come back usually a year or two later. But you know, since we were running 52 weeks a year. That was probably about as long as you could showcase them, you know, before it got tired, you know, using them against the same guys over and over again, or else you had to maybe switch them from heel to babyface. But you know, because it was a long distance away from other territories, guys got settled and maybe didn't want to have that adjustment of having to move to other promotions. So if they were doing well and making money, you know, most of them were happy to stay about 8-9 months.
One guy who was working in your territory, Ross, who changed his name midway, and he became Makan Singh.
Yeah, he did very well. You know, he had kind of a transformation where he adopted kind of a Muslim identity and formed a group called the Karachi Vice with Gama Singh. And then Steve DeSalvo joined and a couple other wrestlers, and he was wearing a turban in the ring, but that transformation revitalized his career because as Mike Shaw, just as the bruising, brawling heel that he was. It was starting to get stale, and we needed to do something else, you know. And we changed his name, and it was a little like Akeem, who changed his name from One Man Gang when he went to WWF, and he had to change his style and persona. And Mike Shaw did that very successfully, and he just became more belligerent and obnoxious in his interviews. And he had a great run, and people soon forgot that he was just Mike Shaw, who was sort of a mid-card performer up till then, and you know, with the right angles and projections in his interviews, he got over very well as a heel, you know, as Muck and Singh, and people forgot the old Mike Shaw image.
Did Jeet Singh work with you guys?
I'm sorry? Tiger Jeet Singh? No, he never did.
Really?
No, unfortunately, never had him in. He wrestled a little bit on the West Coast and in Toronto and in Ontario and a little bit, I think, in Montreal. But because he was booked so often in Japan, and I think he was doing some overseas tours of Australia and New Zealand, we unfortunately never got him in Stampede. But I think he would have drawn very well because there was a large Hindu and Sikh population, and you know, he definitely would have drawn very well. But he never did come in for my dad.
Somebody that most people associate with the South, primarily Knoxville, Tennessee, Georgia, did quite a bit of work in Florida, in and out of Mobile territory. But he actually, I think, got his start there and came back and forth and worked with you guys several times over the years, and that was the Mongolian Stomper, Archie Goldie.
Yeah, Archie was, he was a local boy right from Carbon, which was just about 40 miles out of Calgary, and he always enjoyed coming up to Calgary. If he had had a falling out with another promotion or was unhappy with the way things were going in other promotions, Archie could be temperamental and high-strung at times, but he was a great talent in the ring. I think he also liked coming back in Calgary. I think it was one of the few promotions where he actually wrestled just as Archie the Stomper Goldie, and everywhere else he was billed the Mongolian Stomper, and it was the best kept secret almost in wrestling. He was one of the best talkers and interviewers in the business, and he never did that in the South or in the States where he wrestled, because he always had J.J. Dillon or somebody managing him, you know, a mouthpiece speaking for him, and he got over as a Mongolian brawler, and looked the part as well. You know, he was always very well tanned and shaved his head, but when he came back to wrestle for my dad, it was always as Archie the Stomper Goldie, and it was a total change from wherever else he wrestled in the industry. And I think he kind of liked that. You know, it was sort of his different identity, and he didn't have to hide as somebody else that he wasn't. You know, I don't think the Mongolian Stomper gimmick would have gotten over anyway, because everyone knew him as Archie the Stomper Goldie in Calgary anyway. But he still lives, I believe, in the South, and retired there. I heard even up until 4 or 5 years ago he was still active in wrestling, which was great to see. And I know he's taken really good care of his health and was a fitness fanatic, but probably he was him and Abdullah the Butcher were two of the most consistent, the best drawing heels that my dad ever had. You know, my dad made more money with those two stars than anybody, you know, in the peak period from the mid-60s right to the mid-80s.
How about the Tolis brothers?
The Tolis brothers, yeah. John and Chris both worked for my dad late 50s and then a little bit in the late 60s. But for the most part, they seemed to wrestle more in Ontario, around Hamilton and Toronto, and they had a pretty good stint in Vancouver, working for Sandor Kovacs and Gene Kaniski, and then John made it very big in California, and then never ventured up into Canada too much after his West Coast run in L.A. there.
Yeah, he had a heck of a run out there.
Yeah, I think he and Blassie made I think Los Angeles was just about to go under. They added at least 3 or 4 years to the life of that promotion out there.
Oh, absolutely.
Tom, join in. Throw something out there. We've shoved you off to the corner.
Well, that's okay. I'm enjoying this thoroughly. Believe me. Ross can't wait to get home to Calgary because I'm pumping him for information every minute.
Well, Ross, you'll appreciate this. Abdullah, and funny you mentioned him, that's another one that a Canadian native that wound up living in the South. He lives in outside of Atlanta, has a restaurant there, as most people know. Married a Japanese lady, and they opened the restaurant up in the Ben Hill section of Atlanta. But when he first came into Atlanta, not Jerry, I don't know if you were around then or not, but Bobby tells this story. They first brought him into Atlanta. You know, of course, his gimmick was he was the madman from the Sudan who didn't speak English, and he was just barely above a Neanderthal. And the first road trip he made, he was going from Atlanta to Augusta, I think Bobby said it was. And Bobby and somebody else passed him along the way, and he was driving a convertible, and he had a house phone, and he had the cord stuck down in the ashtray of his car, and he was talking on it like he had a car phone, trying to impress somebody. And here they've been building him up as this wild man, and he's driving up and down the road talking on the phone.
That's the butcher.
Oh, he's a character.
Abdullah was an amazing contradiction. You know, he was like a cannibal in the ring, you know, using forks and glass on his opponents, and yet outside you'd see him dressed in a beautiful suit, you know, or a turtleneck or, you know, alligator shoes and, you know, dressed very high class, you know, and well-groomed, and yet when he was in the ring, you know, it would usually be a blood path, and he'd be carving up his opponents, and, you know, fans never seemed to question that. They just sort of thought that it was a contradiction, but he was an amazing character, and, you know, there's no doubt he got heat, and he made money and drew a lot of business everywhere he went.
Still works every once in a while. He can't get in the ring anymore. And basically people just want to see him jab somebody with a fork, and he does that, and that's, they go home happy. Abby is he's one of a kind, that's for sure. Not another one, that somebody that spent quite a bit of time out in Calgary was Stan Stasiak.
Yeah, Stan was a great heel. He did very well for my dad. He had a great run from about 1967 on. I think he had also wrestled a little bit in the late 50s as Emile Cavalry, but he was a really good heel. He a lot of business for us. I think he had established himself very well on our circuit and the West Coast in Vancouver before he did very well in the WWF and became world champion there, but you know, he was a tremendous heel, and he made my dad a lot of money. He was, you know, a great worker and a great heel.
Jerry, did you ever work with him? I know he came through Georgia.
Yeah, I worked with him here in Georgia.
How was he to work with in the ring?
Good, very good. He's a big man, but, I mean, you know, that didn't matter. He was right there.
Yeah, he was one of the first ones, Stan, to get the heart punch over, and you know, he just got tremendous heat, and that was a finishing move. You know, years later, you saw different wrestlers doing it, but Stan was one of the originators of that, and he got tremendous heat.
I mean, he just did it so well. Where did he start?
I believe Stan started in Montreal. I'm not positive about that. Tom might have a better idea, but I thought he got his start in Montreal as Emile Cavalry. And then I think he worked for Frank Tunney in Toronto and then worked all across the States and Canada. But, you know, I think he worked almost every territory in the business.
Did Joe LeDuc work for you guys? Joe LeDuc, did he work for you guys?
Joe LeDuc, he sure did. Joe and Paul both did. 1968, 69. I think they'd only been wrestling a year or two in Montreal, and then they came to us for seasoning, and I remember it was cold as hell for them. You know, they came and it was minus 30 weather, and I think they had a good experience, but they didn't miss the cold weather. working in our winter territory, but they both did very well. They were good as a tag team, and Joe had some great matches with Archie Goldie. But you know, we were using a lot of wrestlers from Quebec at that time, and it was a great territory to exchange talent with. And eventually, we brought in Abdul the Butcher and Joe Poisson, and Edward Carpentier frequently visited our territory, and it was a really good circuit, and we were lucky to bring in a lot of big names from Quebec.
Joe and Archie worked. They worked.
I'm sorry.
I said Joe and Archie worked in Knoxville against each other. They had a program in Florida. They worked a little bit in Georgia against one another, but they probably had their longest program when Fuller opened up the south version or south end of Southeastern when he bought the fields out in Mobile. They probably had a year run in Mobile. They just packed houses. LeDuc and the Stomper.
Yeah, they had some great matches. Joe, you know, was big enough and strong enough. A lot of fans thought he could sort of stand up to Archie, and they had some great matches. But I think they had their first matches when they worked with my dad in 69, and Archie remembered Joe really well, and I think it was his idea to work against Joe in Florida and in Tennessee there, and they just picked up right where they left off from working in Calgary and had some good matches.
Well, they had some tremendous matches. They were called the Kiwis in Calgary.
Yeah, later I guess the Bushwhackers, but Nick Carter and Sweet William, they had a great run. They worked for my dad on and off from 1974 to about 79. They had first wrestled in Montreal for the Grand Prix promotion, and my dad was so impressed with their matches on TV that when they finished working there, they came in and worked for us, and they had a hell of a run for about 10 months, and they were just great. Nick Carter was doing the crazy Nick gimmick and twitching his head, and you know, Sweet William was just a hell of a bumper. You know, he was one of the best flyers in the business at that time, but they were one of our best tag teams of all time, and they were successful everywhere they went. They had a great run in Portland for Don Owen, and then the Carolinas as the Sheep Herders. But I had great memories of the Kiwis.
Ross, were they working as the Kiwis in Montreal?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. I guess they called them the Kiwis because they came in from New Zealand, but then they changed their names a lot. You know, they were called the Sheep Herders later, and then the Bushwhackers when they went to the WWF, but initially they were the Kiwis.
The Calgary is also where the Fabulous Kangaroos, that was their first territory when they came to the States.
I believe it was. You know, I can't remember if they had worked in WWF for Vince McMahon before or after they came here, but they had a really good run here, I think, in the late 50s, or good run in Calgary, I should say. And then we brought them back around 1964. That was the original team of Al Costello and Roy Heffernan. And they were a great tag team. But I know they really made their mark here and then went on to do very well, you know, for Frank Tunney and the Sheik in Detroit, and had a very successful run in the South and the WWF as well. And later we had the Royal Kangaroos of Lord Jonathan Boyd and Norman Frederick Charles, and they had a good run as well. I think our promotion was the last that they teamed before they went their separate ways, so yeah, it was around 1977, but you know, we're certainly very well represented by a lot of the Australians that came up in workforce.
Norman lives in Pensacola now.
Yes, I saw him at a Cauliflower Alley reunion a few years ago, and he looked great. I couldn't believe how good he looked after all these years. Retired for a number of years, and Norman was never known to really look after himself that well. I think he was a bit of a carouser, and you know, he never really trained or worked out that much, but I couldn't believe how good he looked a few years ago. Like, he's obviously got a renewed interest for life, and he looked and sounded great. It was really a pleasure to see him after all those years.
He's having some heart trouble right now. He's a member of the Gulf Coast Wrestling Reunion. He's on the board of directors, as am I. And when I'm not on the road with the circus, well, if I'm in Mobile when they have a meeting, I see him there. And he's hanging in there, but his health's not doing the best right now. But he and his wife Ann, they were splitting their time between, because they still have a home in England. They were spending part of the year in Pensacola, but I think they're pretty much staying in Pensacola now because it's not easy for him to travel anymore.
No, geez, give him my best wishes for a speedy recovery, and he had a great run for us. Norman was a real character wrestler. You know, he went on to do very well in singles for us after he'd split up with Lord Jonathan Boyd, but he was one of the best heels that helped us launch the Dynamite Kid when we first brought him over from England, and Norman really launched him. He was a heel at the time, and he had a great rivalry with Dynamite, my brother Brett as well, when he was first starting, and Norman really helped launch some of those careers. He was a good heel that was experienced and led a lot of these young guys, and they just listened to him, and he made them look great, and he certainly did a lot for our promotion. So I wish him well, and I hope he can make a speedy recovery.
Well, speaking of Jonathan Boyd, well, not Jonathan Boyd, but John Foley, did he have any influence on the Davey Boy and Dynamite Kid having the British Bulldog name?
He didn't. You know, he was a manager of Dynamite Kid for a number of years when Dynamite had been with us for about a year as a baby face, and then we decided, and actually it was Dick Steinborn's idea, Dick was our booker at the time, to switch Dynamite into a heel and have John Foley manage him, kind of corrupt his mind. And at the time, John was had inherited a large sum of money from an aunt of his, and was billed as a millionaire manager, and it got over just great, but he took Dynamite or Tom Billington under his wing and toughened him up and taught him how to win matches, and that the nice guy approach didn't work, and so he was the mastermind, I guess, behind Dynamite Kid's transformation. But outside the ring, you know, he was very close to Dynamite. They enjoyed drinking and singing songs together, and they had a lot of great road trips together. They partied a lot, and I know John certainly did have an influence more on Dynamite, I guess, than Davey. And John unfortunately passed away, I think, about 1988. But he really wasn't instrumental in the Bulldogs becoming a team, but he did have a strong personal influence on Dynamite Kid. And John was a great guy to have on the road. You know, he loved living for the wrestling trips. You know, he enjoyed the road trips and socializing, and certainly having a share of booze and drinks. And that's kind of the way he lived right to the end. He kind of partied right to the end, but that was living on his terms. But you know, he certainly had a great relationship with Tom Billington.
Well, the reason I asked that question, because John and his son-in-law, Ted Heath, worked in the Mobile territory in 75 and 76 as a tag team, and they were called the British Bulldogs.
That's interesting. I never knew that. You know, I'm not sure who came up with the name of the British Bulldogs. No, it's an interesting coincidence, but I know when they first wrestled for us, we didn't come up with the name the British Bulldogs, but Vince McMahon certainly adopted it very quickly when he signed them and called them the British Bulldogs. But that, you know, maybe that idea was in Dynamite's head from John Foley. I wouldn't be surprised. So they were called the British Bulldogs. I thought it was the English Bulldogs, but they're actually called the British.
They started out the first couple of weeks they were there. They were called the English Bulldogs, and then they twisted and were called the British Bulldogs for the next 6 or 8 months, however long they were there.
Wow! Imagine if they had patented that name. You know, I don't think the WWF could have launched them as such, and we would have never known them as that name. You know, because it certainly led to their stardom and fame. You know, it was a great name for them, and then Davey Boy wrestled as the British Bulldog individually, and he actually copyrighted the name, and and the WWF couldn't take that away from him. He had his own trademark on the British Bulldog name, but that's it's interesting trivia that John and Ted actually had used that name in the 1970s. Wow.
Yes, sure did. They even had a mask of that little stuffed bulldog that the kid lived with called Sir Winston.
Oh, geez, that's incredible.
That's
they were the best interviews.
That's good information there.
I think those guys were ahead of their time. They really were.
Yeah, that if they stuck around long enough to turn babyface, they probably could have sold a bunch of those dogs. If you
remember. Well, Mike, Mike and Jerry, we really appreciate you guys letting us get on air here.
We had a
long night last night, a big day tomorrow. But I just want to appreciate you letting us get on the air program.
Well, we appreciate you guys being here.
Well, we'll have to get Ross back on once he's through running the roads. And
it was my pleasure to be on, and I would look forward to being back on your show soon. Thanks so much for having me on, guys.
Thank you for being on.
Glad to do it, Tom. Appreciate it.
Okay, yeah, my pleasure. We'll catch you down the road.
Okay, take care, guys.
Yep.
Good night,
bye-bye.
Guys.
Well, gee, how's that? Wow.
You there, Mike?
Yeah, I'm here.
That's very interesting.
What's that?
Very interesting.
Oh, yeah. Well, you grew up in a family around that, you're going to know you're wrestling.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you can't help it. See, that's think about that. 50 years, Stu Hart ran that territory.
Isn't that something?
Can you imagine that?
It's unbelievable.
Bills had a long run with 15 years, but 50 years is a long time.
A long time.
I can't imagine anybody else that ran that long. Maybe Don Owen.
Oh, maybe. He might have, yeah. He'd have been the only one.
That'd be the only two. I mean, consistent, the same promoter. A lot of them, you know, that passed through family hands. Paul Jones, I mean, people look at Paul Jones as being the Atlanta promoter forever, but most people don't realize Paul Jones really wasn't the Atlanta promoter. He was a big
right.
Man. He had points in the office, but he really didn't run the day-to-day operation. But, yeah, I would think it'd be close between Don Owen and Stu Hart as to who promoted the longest. Well, the Tunneys maybe. Maybe the Tunneys may be in there somewhere, too. Because I think Frank Tunney promoted Toronto for, I don't know when he started, surely sometime in the 50s, and he was
yeah, well, mad
into the 80s. So, but anyway, well, I enjoyed that. I appreciate
yes,
it doing our show for us. Anything you want to add before we sign off?
No, you just have a great week up there and finish the week out and get back down south.
I am. I'm going to try and do that. Our friend Ron West's birthday is tomorrow, so I'm taking him out to lunch tomorrow.
Well, good. Tell him I said happy birthday.
I certainly will. I don't know if he'll own up as to how old he is, but...
no, he's not going to tell that.
No, Ron. You never know.
Exactly.
But, next week, we will be joined next week by Scott Till, and he promises a special guest for us. And Till won't tell me who it is, but we've got some other things in the hopper for the upcoming weeks that we're working on, some surprises. So everybody stay tuned, and I guarantee you you'll get something out of our show.
That's for sure.
A headache.
I'm going to take some Excedrin now,
you
myself.
You take care, Jay, and have a good weekend. And we'll all be, all three of us next week will be on, so we'll be back to full strength.
Okay, Mike.
And, all right, you too, Jay. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.